Good afternoon, and welcome to another in a series of Torrin Motion panels. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamud, and I'm really pleased that you could join us. We're not going to go over the full biographies of these gentlemen, because if you've been here, you'll have heard them. But briefly, on one end we have Ethan Eisenberg. Ethan runs Second Look Productions in Manhattan, and he attended Shivat Shalvim and Shivat Haaretz Yion, and he has just produced, directed, created the film Lonely Man of Faith, which we had the privilege of watching last night. It was a wonderful film, very moving, very powerful film, and I'm sure will be a great success with those people who see it, and I would urge people to see it when it reappears. Next to me, Rabbi Shalom Carmi, the editor of Tradition, teaches philosophy and Jewish studies at Yeshiva University. Spoke earlier today on the Rav's vision of God. On my left, Dr. David Schatz, who you've just heard give his presentation on the Rav and evil. Dr. Schatz is professor of philosophy at Yeshiva University and the associate professor of religion at Columbia. And on my far left, Dr. Arnold Lustiger, who has a PhD in materials engineering and has put together 1,000 hours of recordings of the Rav and made 3 books available on these shiurim, including Before Hashem You Shall Be Purified, Drashot HaRav, and of course the Yom Kippur Machzor, which was just put out this past Yamim Noraim. We asked these gentlemen to come together because we wanted to discuss and really probe certain issues in the life and thought of Rav Soloveitchik that have inspired a lot of discussion and also a lot of confusion. I wanted to begin with the theme that was actually touched upon briefly by Rabbi Carmi earlier this morning, but I think requires more thought, and that is the discussion, and much of it has been fiercely contradictory, of the role that secular studies, i.e. philosophy, science, literature, history, played in the Weltanschauung and the practical reality of Rav Soloveitchik. His brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, and his eulogy for the Rav seemed to imply that this kind of knowledge was fundamentally utilitarian for the Rav. It was used in order to address the modern American student. I'm not going to go into the whole eulogy if you've read it. It was a discussion of different kinds of the ways that light is produced, refraction, diffraction, and in it, it seemed clear that his view was that the Rav was talking about secular studies in order to better address the modern student. My question is, did the Rav consider such studies intrinsically valuable and meaningful in their own right, or were they by definition for him simply an adjunct to Torah study? Leo Strauss's formulation, which he really took from the medievals, a handmaid to the queen of Torah, and where do you feel that such disciplines actually, what they meant for the Rav? And we'll start with you, Professor Schatz.
I mean, I've struggled with this question because I can really see a kind of two-step way of dealing with it. My first thought was that for Rav Soloveitchik, secular studies really are, in some sense, a handmaiden. That is, they're a tool towards understanding Torah concepts. I mean, when you look at his published works, and he draws upon secular studies, he draws upon philosophers and scientists and so forth, they're pressed into the service of trying to give a kind of Judaic worldview. And in that sense, I think he thought that they were very, very important for understanding Torah, for understanding Judaism, for understanding the nature of the human being as conceived by Judaism, and so forth. One way to think about this, perhaps, is to take some essay by the Rav, you know, that strikes you as particularly compelling, let's say an essay from the book Family Redeemed or Out of the Whirlwind or any of those other books that I sound like I'm plugging right now, extract from it anything that was influenced by secular thought. Then see what's left. Then compare what's left to what's actually there. And what you will have on one side is a mountain, and on the other side, at best, a molehill. So I think that the Rav used secular studies to explicate the Torah concepts. Now, the question is, though, given all that, did he see intrinsic value in secular studies such that even if they were not serviceable in the study of Torah, they would nevertheless be valuable? And I think there the answer is kind of yes, because of the fact that once you take secular knowledge to be a source of truth, it would be very odd to take the view that truth is not intrinsically valuable. So in other words, people who study only secular studies and don't study Torah concepts at all are studying things that are intrinsically valuable. So I think in the published works, in other words, in short, in the published works, I think that there is a sense in which they're serving as a handmaiden. But I think that once you realize that they can serve as a handmaiden only if they have intrinsic value, then I think, you know, one has to say they have intrinsic value. One last comment about this, though, is that Professor Yitzhak Twersky, you know, took the view that the Rav never really justifies his view of secular studies, his openness to secular studies. I think you could make a case that he actually does provide such a justification in Lonely Man of Faith, but I will leave that to the side if I'm talking too long.
I generally don't like to rely too heavily on personal conversations because then everybody makes up their own, and but in this case, I will make an exception. There are conversations that I had with the Rav that are relevant to this. I would say, by and large, in making educational choices and discussing this for other people, he thought that secular studies are important as tools towards gaining certain types of insights. The way he put it frequently, if you want to get from New York to Boston in 2 hours, you have to take the plane. If you don't take the plane, you clearly aren't interested in getting from New York to Boston in a short period of time. And likewise, if you have the insights you gain from certain disciplines and that helps you to get a grip on life, if that's what you want to do, then you use the means that you need. If you don't want to do it, then you're giving that up. Again, in most of his published work, that is true as well, that he's using this entire arsenal of university studies, liberal arts studies, as a way of promoting an understanding of Bar Hashem and the role of a person in this world. At the same time, I agree with Professor Schatz that if something is true and something gives you insight, and that is valuable in and of itself. And I would go further and say that for the Rav himself, that was a value. On a couple of occasions, he spoke to me about that. He felt that of his written works, The Halachic Mind was primarily an essay in general philosophy of science with very little of distinctively Jewish about it. Most of the book could have been written by a guy, I'm quoting him. This was the only work of his he regarded as purely philosophical. It's his understanding of philosophy was epistemology, what do we know, how do we know it, which means that Halachic Man, Vikashtim, all these very important works are not purely philosophical works for him. These are works that require philosophical training to write and to understand, but they're not inherently philosophical works. On a couple of occasions, he expressed regret that he had not written more works in general philosophy. And he made it clear. He said, don't think for a minute that I didn't do more in this area because of Bitul Torah. I see no contradiction, no conflict between achieving excellence in Torah study and making an important contribution in some other discipline. What he regretted was tzorchei tzibur, that the third element, in addition to Torah and other studies, he also had to make a commitment to communal affairs, and that he felt interfered with his being able to fulfill himself in this area. And it's interesting that, it's something to remember, that a person like that, with whatever his intellectual dreams were, made a very conscious sacrifice for the sake of Talmidim, for the sake of the community. He limited himself, and he gave up certain things, perhaps in Torah as well. As Rav Shach pointed out earlier today, he didn't give public shiurim in Kodshim and Taharot except to selected people. He decided to focus on certain aspects of Torah. But inherently, he regarded this as a valuable thing for himself and presumably for other people as well, assuming that it doesn't conflict with priorities of Torah study.
It's difficult to address the question. With the limited background that I have, there is a tape. It requires a lot of analysis where the Rav does discuss secular studies. It's a well-known tape, Mina Ramatayim Tzofim. He discusses the homiletically, if you will, two mountains, Mina Ramatayim Tzofim. There's Torah, and then, if you will, there's secular knowledge. The question is, obviously, and I don't think it's explicit in the tape, to what extent is it necessary to scale one or the other? I'd like to ask the other panelists, though, to what extent for, quote, a normal balabas, as opposed to, say, an academic, whether or not this discussion is, in fact, academic. Someone who is, in fact, you know, working in a business or in a job 8 hours a day, and he comes home, does he have a Seder in Immanuel Kant? I just want to know, how do you deal with it? What, in other words, you have a limited amount of time. You have obviously an imperative to learn Torah. You have an imperative to have siddurim regularly. I'm not sure to what extent there is a similar imperative. If you read Torah Mada by Norman Lamb, it suggests that there might even be something of an imperative along those lines. But from a practical standpoint, I don't see how it can be actualized.
Try to respond to that interesting question. First, let me mention that Ramatayim Tzofim is actually published, at least adapted, in one of the books. Get which one?
Adam V'Olamo, but it's not very well done.
Okay, yeah. I think you did talk about the possibility. Some people have tried to build a bridge between them, and sometimes you can't. Okay, but... as far as the question, what it means for the average balabas, I think that this has to do with another thought that the Rav had, and that is that in general, people were, he says, very focused on halacha and were not open to the realm of machshava. I mean, he expressed dissatisfaction with this many times. One particularly pungent statement he made is that if I give a shiur on basar b'chalav at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, they'll all flock to me. But when I talk about the philosophy, they think I'm an epicurus. So first of all, I think he thought that people ought to sort of know philosophy better, machshava, and if we make the assumption that both me and Rabbi Karmi, were making, then that you need some sort of philosophical background to understand the machshava. So that's one way to look at what a practical consequence would be, that there should be some seder in machshava also. A second thing that comes to mind, though, is very, you know, just on the very practical level, is the questions that are debated today about college education, graduate school, and so forth. I think on that level, it does have practical application. I did notice that you said the discussion is academic. It's always amused me that the word academic has come to mean irrelevant. And we academics live with this all the time.
Could I just jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
As a non-expert, non-academic, just wanted, obviously all of my knowledge comes from basically people I've interviewed and spoken with, articles I've read by the three people sitting at the table. I read Dr. Lustiger's two books that he compiled of the Rav's works, and I've read many articles by Rabbi Karmi and by Dr. Schatz and spoken to them. But from my observations, there's something that people sometimes leave out when they talk about the Rav. You know, some say that there's the Rav in New York and the Rav in Boston. Well, the Rav in Boston had a school in Boston. It's called the Maimonides School. The Rav founded it in the late 30s, and he was active in putting together the curriculum, he was more directly active in the Torah curriculum, but he knew what was going on in the general studies curriculum. And he took a lot of pride in the fact that in his school, they taught the kids secular studies and that they tried to teach to a level that they can compete with any school. At that time, I was told that the school to beat was Boston Latin. And that was where the kids used to go when they didn't have a Torah studies, and that was really the standard bearer. That was the Harvard of high schools, if you could use that term. And they took a lot of pride in the students who got into very good schools. In fact, on a practical level, apparently the Rav would encourage students who got into YU to think about applying to some other schools. And if they got into YU and Yale or YU and Harvard, many times he would push the kids to go to Harvard, which is interesting because he was teaching at YU and he was the reason why many people went to YU. And in terms of his own students at YU, it was well known that if the students went to him and asked him for advice where they should go next, he pushed students to go to graduate school. In fact, even Rav Lichtenstein told me in the interview, it doesn't appear in the film, but he says, it didn't even occur to me to go to Harvard until the Rav told me I should go to Harvard. Even Rabbi Braunspiegel, who is not a fan of Torah Umada, was encouraged by the Rav to go to graduate school. He wasn't interested. And Rav Schaffer said to me, and this is brutally honest, but I think it also says a lot about his stance and stance of others. He says, when people would ask the Rav if they should go to graduate school, the Rav would encourage them to go to graduate school. I never asked him.
I just want to mention the thing about the Maimonides school. There was a speech the Rav gave in 1972 at the Maimonides school where he actually articulated a kind of Torah Umada objective or mission for the Maimonides school.
Yeah, and in his talk in 1970 about YU, he took a lot of pride about the fact that students could go to Shir and then a few hours later go upstairs and take a class in physics. So it was clear that he took a lot of pride in it, even though he himself never gave an official essay that endorsed the program
It was claimed that these are political moves, that given the parents were sending their kids to Maimonides, that they wouldn't be happy unless there was a push towards secular excellence.
Do you buy it?
But I'm not commenting that. I didn't live in Boston. Rabbi Wurzburg...
That's why you're here, actually. you got to comment on stuff like this.
Rabbi Wurzburg Stone of Bracha was not here, not with us. Told me that he went to Harvard because it had told him to get a PhD in philosophy, period. That otherwise he was not well-to-do, he was a refugee, and all he wanted to do was to Rabbanu, to do chinuch, to do something decent with his life, and it was purely a matter of directing him. The practical question, I think somebody who has a good liberal arts education is capable of continuing on in life, balancing things in the future. If you don't have that background, then you really can't start. You're going to go into life, nothing but philosophy, nothing but literature, nothing but history. And then you're 25 years old, you're 30 years old, you have a family, you have a job, you want to learn Torah. And somebody said, well, make a few hours to read a novel or to read Kant. It's really very difficult. That's the purpose of a liberal arts education, is to prepare people to continue on their own this way. And I'll speak, I think it up, probably erred in the direction of overestimating people's abilities rather than underestimating them. But except from my own experience, speak for myself, I don't want to denigrate myself, but look at many of my students, the people who are the most complete intellectually, looking back 20, 15 years after graduated college, most complete in the sense of Torah and Machshava, and being aware of what's going on in the world, and being intelligent, and being able to pick up a secular book when they want to or need to. These are not always the people with the highest IQ. This is not a task that is only available for the Rav and other contexts might call the intellectual virtuosos. People who are just above average can also do it very well.
I'm self-censoring. I got to come back to you later on this one.
I want to lay out for you something that's bothered me a long time, and I guess the best way of putting it is I'm bothered by what the Rav is not bothered by. And this is what I mean. There's an essay that's well known to people who study Jewish philosophy by Emmanuel Levinas called Revelation in the Jewish Tradition. And in the essay, Levinas lays out a picture of modern people having great difficulties with basic religious concepts like revelation from Sinai. It's hard for modern people to believe in such things. They are, he says, perplexed by the very possibility of this kind of idea. And the reason is because of all the intellectual disciplines they've been exposed to in modernity, whether it's psychoanalysis or whether it's deconstruction or whether it's sociology. We don't need to get into that, but the shortcut is that for many modern people, after the Enlightenment, there's an enormous crisis of religious faith. In contrast to that, Levinas lays out another kind of person who he says, quote, crosses the deserts of the religious crisis of our time, seemingly untouched and unaffected by the uncertainties of modernity. And they live in a significant sense, says Levinas, outside of history. Now, if you look at Lonely Man of Faith early in the book, the Rav writes the following, quote, I have never been seriously troubled by the problem of the biblical doctrine of creation vis-a-vis the scientific story of evolution at both the cosmic and the organic levels. I have not been perplexed by the impossibility of fitting the mystery of revelation into the framework of historical empiricism. I have not even been troubled by the theories of biblical criticism, which contradict the very foundations upon which the sanctity and integrity of the scriptures rest. So I'm not bothered by modern science. I'm not bothered by modern literary theory. I'm not bothered by modern epistemology. My question is, why not? Why is the Rav not bothered by these things? Did he feel that they weren't questions at all? Did he feel that simple faith simply overrode these dilemmas? Was he like Levinas's man just existing outside of history? Or is he trying to show maybe by creating Adam 1 and Adam 2 and showing a kind of double typology that this is the way you answer biblical criticism, you show the reason that the stories are repeated because they're talking to two different kinds of people, etc. But you get my drift.
First let me mention that there's a very good, in fact, an excellent discussion of this very question by Rabbi Reuven Ziegler, which is found on the Virtual Based Medrash website, the VBM of Yeshivat Har Etzion, and will appear in an even longer version, I think, in his forthcoming book on the Rav's philosophy, which is a book that I would recommend in the absolute strongest terms once it comes out. He's really terrific. And he has a discussion of this. Let me just say a couple of things. First, in general, what the Rav was interested in his writings, and you know this already from my talk on evil, was not metaphysics or not even what we call truth claims, but rather what he was interested in is what they call phenomenology. In other words, the description of the inner experience of the religious person. And to that extent, he would put aside these questions in his writings. They simply didn't fit into what his project is. And A Lonely Man of Faith, he says this a couple of times. He starts off by saying that my aim here is not the old question about faith and reason. He says theoretical dichotomies have not, theoretical problems have not tormented me. He's trying to do a different type of philosophy. And Rabbi Ziegler explains this, if I just quote one paragraph from this. He says, I believe that the Rav's primary reason for not writing about these subjects was that he simply did not regard them as the most important issues or the main problems facing Judaism in the modern world. The main arena of combat, in his opinion, was the soul, not the mind. We saw that the Rav believed that the God experience lies at the core of faith, and the role of the intellect is only ancillary and subsequent to the faith experience. Therefore, there is no point in addressing questions of the intellect before one establishes within himself an experiential basis of faith. In other words, what he's really trying to do is to connect people on an experiential basis to religion, to Judaism. Now, this still doesn't answer quite Dr. Malamud's question, because the question is really about the words I am not bothered by. Now, one way to understand this is simply that I'm not bothered by, meaning that I have faith. And then I don't, and there's nothing more to say about it than that. But if you notice, to a certain extent, he does deal with some of these questions in his writings. For example, with respect to evolution, I mean, he doesn't simply say, well, evolution is false because the tradition says otherwise. But instead, in the book Emergence of Ethical Man, it's quite clear that he accepts evolution. And I knew this anyway from a teacher at Maimonides School who told me years ago that he had once asked the Rav, how should he teach biology? I mean, evolution is in the textbook. The Rav says, you teach the textbook. So he seemed here to have some sort of accommodation to the modern world. On the issue of biblical criticism, he seems not to have budged. On the question of the materialistic view of the human being, that's something which likewise he addresses in Emergence of Ethical Man. So some of these problems that he says he wasn't bothered by, he actually took up. Which leads me to think that perhaps the words I am bothered by is what you sometimes find in the Rav, and that is a kind of rhetorical excess. And maybe he wasn't bothered, but he did grapple with them to an extent. Maybe he wasn't bothered in the sense that he didn't think that his faith, would ever be shot. But there was a certain amount of grappling that went on. I also remember, the last point is, I also remember from Shear, he very often would say, somebody would ask him a kasha, and he'd say, that doesn't bother me. And then the next day he'd come in, and he was so tormented by that question. So, I think it might be a rhetorical flourish.
I think there is an emphasis in that paragraph in telling people, you think that these are the questions that really should bother you, and I'm telling you, put it aside, focus on the real issues. And the real issues are what are called circumcising the heart, becoming a more sensitive person, becoming more real in that regard. Let me put it differently. If you have a person who is not bothered by these problems, and for the Rav, the reason he was not bothered by evolution is that he didn't think it was a major challenge, mostly. In terms of biblical criticism, it's because he didn't give it very much credence. If somebody is not bothered by these questions, there's no particular reason for them to make themselves be bothered by those questions, to force yourself to be bothered by it. If I have no problem with issues of biblical criticism, why should I be bothered by it? If I think that they ask good questions, and personally I'm probably more involved in these issues than anybody else here, it's because I think some of the questions are interesting. And therefore, as the Rav did in Non Man of Faith regarding Reish Talif and Perbeit, as the Rav did in Kuntres Avodat Hayom, which nobody talks about because it's Rosh Yeshiva talking, where he discusses the structure of the Parsha of Yom Kippur, and there also he's very quietly dealing with problems that the critics raise. He was very much aware of biblical criticism up to a certain period. I mean, when he was in university, he knew everything that was going on. He didn't really keep up that much later on. Maybe not at all, beyond a certain point. But if you're not bothered by those questions, then why should you be bothered by them? The other kinds of questions, the questions of evil, the questions of the loneliness of religious man in the modern world, these are questions, if you're not bothered by them, you really ought to. You really are missing something not being bothered by them. There may be people who believe that the questions of biblical criticism and so on are questions that we ought to be bothered by. These are really core questions in developing our own hashkafa, our own Weltanschauung, that I do not think so. What the real issues are, what do you do with your life? How do you relate to God? What do you do with yourself?
I just want to jump in, and maybe I'll direct this to Ethan. The Rav says in Lonely Man of Faith, and Rav Karmi just sort of repeated it, that the loneliness comes from being this sort of religious, passional man
in the face of this kind of technocratic modernity where everybody is impressed by the domination of nature, by science-based technology, and where does the man of faith exist? But one of the things that struck me in seeing the film last night, and I've thought about it before, is whether it was possible that the Rav was actually lonely within the religious community, right? The typology sets up there is that you have a person who's lonely because he's out of sync with sort of secular technocratic modernity, but the picture that emerges from the film is actually a kind of loneliness within Orthodox reality that nobody could actually relate to him on that level. I wonder how you felt when you were doing this, whether that seemed the case to you as well.
The way I understood Lonely Man of Faith was to a large degree with the help of that same essay that Dr. Schatz referred to by Rabbi Reuven Ronnie Ziegler, Diversal by Midrash, where he spends several email shirim, I think he called them, on Lonely Man of Faith, and pointed out that really the loneliness is not just, it's not like somebody in the observing community versus the outside world. I think his point in the essay is that this is a struggle that's not only going on in the outside world, but it's going on within the religious community and to a certain degree within the soul of every person of faith. In that, you know, the technological background was just sort of setting the stage for what the, you know, typology of the extreme pure Adam One person would be. Someone who's just out for practical gain, someone who's out for to better the world in a practical sense, and uses technology towards whatever means he can. But that sort of the world of Adam One infiltrated the world of Adam Two. It's taken over the world of faith. And that even in religious communities now, religion was being viewed from a very selfish, practical point of view. We used some comments of Rabbi Carmi. We took them a little bit out of context, but we thought they fit in the context there, where he said that, you know, that people would say, that Rav would talk about people who would say, you know, what can religion do for me, that it's good for the digestion, for family life. In this sense, it was also the sense that they just didn't feel that, I think for the Rav, the main message of religion is it expects you to struggle, it expects you to sacrifice, it demands a lot from you. And he saw people treating religion as something that's either purely intellectual or meant to just make people feel good. And actually for me as a filmmaker, when I was trying to figure out how central that concept should be, a lot of it was tied into what was going on in the 50s and 60s. And I did a little bit of a historical read and found out that there are these top sellers all the time that are these like sort of self-help books on religion. I forgot the name of the person who put these out. But
Joshua Liebman.
Liebman. Yeah, Peace of Mind, exactly. We were going to show like a cover of a book, Peace of Mind. But that's what people would buy. And it was basically you would take religion, you would empty it of all really observant content and really religious content, and you'd make it into basically a feel-good book. And any book that comes out today that says lessons of how to live your life properly, they would make that into a religious message, and then you'd read it, and you'd feel good. And he felt that that was really the problem with society at the time. But I think it's a problem even today. I mean, look at new spirituality, look at the search for, I mean, people, for some people, a religious experience is doing yoga once a week. And that's really, I think, taken over for a lot of people as to what religion means. But even within Orthodoxy, there isn't a real sense of sacrifice for a lot of people. So I think that was the loneliness. For the Rav, lonely didn't mean you didn't have friends. Lonely meant that you couldn't connect to people. Lonely also meant you were homelessness and you were rootless, you weren't rooted. But in the sense of the pain that I think he felt in Lonely Man of Faith is he didn't feel like he could connect, he could communicate to modern man. That was my reading of it.
I want to pick up on this a little bit. I mean, there are certain ways in which in the modern world, what the Rav says resonates even more than it did before. I mean, for example, there's much more commercialism now in the sort of the selling of religion. Also, religion has become much more individualistic, and that sort of gets away from the idea of faith communities, which the Rav stresses. So religion sort of moved in a direction that I think is even more inimical to the Rav's vision than it was before. But there's one additional thing I think we have to consider. The Rav was really talking about the place of man in a secular society. The society we live in today is largely religious. The world is largely religious. America, where I come from, is largely religious. What type of religion do we have? All right, and consider the threat from Islam. I mean, essentially, this is religion, arguably, with the aims of Adam the First. That is, aims of control and domination and power, which are really removed from what the religious life is actually like. So I think if we were to sort of update Lonely Man of Faith 40 years later, I think it might look a bit different, because the society is certainly less secular than it was, and the terms of exactly what Adam the First is doing might be different. But yet, I think the essay still remains relevant.
Only thing we add, and you look in the Lonely Man of Faith in the last pages, that Uff speaks about cultural religion. He's very explicit that people can be members of a religious community in good standing, but their religion is not really part of what he's talking about. Their religion is part of their secular culture. It just happens to work for them. Mm-hmm. Religion is part of human culture. It can be a religious experience. Mysticism, institutional religion can all be part of a secular cultural agenda. Rabbi Wurzburger, who I quoted earlier today, had a quip about the great achievement of modern orthodoxy being the multiplication of the number of brands of chocolate that have a shadim. That belongs to Adam 1.
Let's tie together the two threads here, though. You see, this is what puzzled me before. On the one hand, there's an argument that the Rav is saying that there are certain questions you shouldn't be bothered by. You should be bothered by a certain kind of alienation, a certain kind of distance from God. On the other hand, Levinas is pointing out that de facto, people are alienated from the religious project because they do not believe in the same way people used to believe about religion. And they've been thrown off, whether consciously or unconsciously. I agree with you that people don't sit down consciously and read Darwin and say, okay, I'm not going to believe in God anymore. But what I am arguing is that somehow, in the cultural mother's milk, there's a notion that these kinds of belief systems are hard to buy into. So what happens? People go the back door, what you're talking about, the search for spirituality, right, which replaces mainline religion. But what I'm posing to you, Rabbi Karmi, is that isn't that search for spirituality, maybe devoid of sacrifice, really the end, the logical, ineluctable end point of what happens when people can't get satisfied by religion? They don't buy into traditional religious tenets, so of course they want something. There's a search for meaning, and it goes the other way. So in fact, what doesn't bother the Rav is bothering a lot of people a lot, and by saying, you know, you shouldn't be bothered by this, isn't he really avoiding what the secular Jew really wants to know? It's like, why should I buy into this?
At an educational level, I suspect the Rav's response would be... can you hear me?
Yeah.
At an educational level, I think the Rav's basic response would be that you expose people to what religion is about. You help people to grasp what it really is. And that once they have grasped that, they may be able to look at the world in different ways. Kierkegaard made the distinction direct communication, indirect communication. Direct communication, I tell somebody this is the way it is, and I argue for it, and that's it. Indirect communication means that I bring the person into the position where they can understand where I'm coming from. I don't think that I believe that beyond that you can do very much. Karl Barth, the great Protestant theologian whom Rav spoke highly of in certain contexts, said belief can preach to unbelief, but cannot argue with it. Barth liked extreme formulations. Rav never used that particular formulation, but I could see it resonating with him, and it certainly is a practical educational matter.
So just to clarify, so you're saying in a way the Rav believed that you could, so to speak, take the Jew to the water, you could show him what's in the water, it's his choice to drink, There's nothing you can do about it. You have to sort of let it be as it is.
Isha Lacha is descriptive. Now, there's no doubt that the Rav wants to describe in such a way that it will make the Isha Lacha attractive or respectable. But it's a right. It's a descriptive statement. In Wikashtim, there is a footnote, footnote 6, which raises a problem of people who may understand man's quest for God, but resist the idea of finding God's response to man. And the Rav implies that that's kind of masochism. People who are coming to the water and realize that there's something missing and then refuse to respond to what is being offered. That may be true of a certain kind of secularist. I've seen, I think, Avi Sagi, you mentioned Camus in that regard. I think that I'm probably thinking more about somebody like Kafka. Is it true of all secularists phenomenologically? I'm not sure. But this is one place that he addresses a point, as far as I know.
Just one quick thing relevant to this idea of sort of bracketing all of these problems. There's been a lot of discussion ever since the Rav died and a lot of attempts to deal with this as to how to institute the Rav into high school education and to a certain extent the college education. And I think one of the obstacles to introducing him into high school education in a way that students will find compelling is the fact that a lot of them are hung up on these intellectual problems. And I think that's a tremendous obstacle. When they deal with evil, they will want more than the approach that I mentioned before, the approach of the topical halacha. When they come across biblical criticism, they will want more than what I described. When they learn a little about neuroscience, they will want more. They work essentially on an intellectual plane. That's my personal belief. I'm not a psychologist, but I was speaking about this earlier with Dr. Malamud's wife about this. When people come in with these intellectual dilemmas, very often there is some sort of a personal thing going on. But still, if that personal thing is going on in one person, it could be going on in a lot of people. And so the question is how to sort of, you know, take people whose mindset is intellectual and they want answers to everything, and how do you present the Rav in a way that they're going to find engaging?
I'm just going to shift a bit here and ask Dr. Lustiger. A number of times today, we've heard about various formulations about the relationship that the Rav had with Zionism. How did he see the land of Israel? How did he see the Zionist project? What did he see as the theological status of a secular state? Maybe another way of formulating this, did he see the land as inherently holy, similar to the Shitot of Yehuda Levi or Rav Kook? Or does he see its sacredness as more functional in a kind of Maimonidean way? How do you think the Rav would relate even today, speculatively, about things like settlements, the tension in Israel today after the disengagement? It's hard to get a feel of what did he actually think religiously about these issues.
Well, as far as the land being intrinsically holy, there's no question it's intrinsically holy. It's intrinsically holy whether there's a state of Israel, whether there isn't a state of Israel. There is a Kedusha. The Kedusha is enduring. He discussed it innumerable
times. You're saying from his point of view?
From the standpoint. I mean, just objectively, I think from the standpoint of Gemara, I don't think he's
that is
just
a question.
It's an opinion. I don't know. I'm not sure. As far as the nature of Zionism, I can only speak again from I think Dr. Carmi has a better perspective from a personal way. I know that he had specific conversations with the Rav regarding Hallel, regarding issues like that. As you could hear from the drasha that I presented today, the Rav's relationship to Zionism, there was not an element of messianism at all. And I think that lack of messianism flies in the face of the conventional religious Zionists today. And the withdrawal from Gaza resulted in a huge crisis of faith for the average religious Zionist, that's too strong a word, for many of the religious Zionists who have followed, the prescriptions of Merkaz Hareb Kook, where in fact the settlements settling the land, settling the West Bank, settling Gaza, was in fact if not halachically, practically, I think their most important imperative. And I think it dealt immeasurable damage, personally, to the religious Zionist enterprise. Now, I have, unfortunately, that's probably a little difficult, but I in fact have a section from the 1967 Shuva Drasha, which I actually subtitled, but it wasn't appropriate for my specific talk, where the Rav says very, very explicitly that if, in fact, the security of the country required giving back the Kotel HaMa'aravi, if, in fact, the security of the country required giving back the Kotel HaMa'aravi, it must be given back. If Pikuach Nefesh is docha mitzvot of the Torah, it certainly is docha territory. Now, this is I should also mention that they gave this immediately after 1967, and he prefaced it by saying that you have to know that the Arabs are Amalek, they have a din of Amalek. Their goal is the destruction of the of Israel, and I think at that point it was academic, but I think he was speaking to the future, not to take this off the table. And unfortunately, I think for many religious Zionists, it has come off the table. I think as a result, there's been a huge alienation. Sociological implications of this have been devastating, I think, for the religious Zionist enterprise. There has been Dr. Crummy can address this much better. I think there's been a recent issue of tradition, which explicitly dealt with this issue, and I'd like him to take up the slack here.
There's an ambiguity in the question. He talked about the inherent Kedusha versus another kind of reading. If you mean by inherent the idea that Kedushat Eretz Yisrael is independent of any human action, which is the position of the Kuzari, the Rav explicitly disagreed with that. And he writes that, with all due respect to the Kuzari, Kedusha always requires a human act, be it in Hilchot Sefer Torah, Tefillin Mezuzah, the Sofer doing the writing, and regarding Eretz Yisrael, an act either of conquest or of Yishuv, whatever. And as he pointed out, when he made the statement in 1967 about returning the land, including even the Kotel, if that is where would actually work for peace, he said, don't tell me that I don't know anything to Shtet Yisrael. How many shiurim did I give and Shoshona, Kitchel Shait, Kitchel Tidlavo, and my great grandfather already gave shiurim on that. And he really went to town about how, on one occasion around that time, he even made the statement, it was a religious Zionist newspaper that was very vociferously against any kind of compromise. And he said, I knew more about the halachic subject when I was a small child in the crib, in my little finger, than the editor of this newspaper knows in his whole body. Which presumably, this is one subject that his father was actually lecturing on during those years that he was in the crib. Right. So he knew what he was talking about there. Having said that, he certainly did not endorse any particular political plan. In the 70s, he often said, you know, if the Arabs came with a peace proposal, the people of Israel would jump on it right away, even if it wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and even if they knew that wasn't worth the paper it was written on, because the people really want peace. He also, and this is again another hand, was always very antagonistic towards Israeli militarism. I saw just earlier this week somebody excavated some newspaper reports of lectures he gave in the 50s. You may have tapes of them. Yom HaTzmaut rushes, and he is very anti-militaristic. The idea that the Israelis think, Ben-Gurion talks, if it It's our own power that means something. And after 67, that fear became sharper. There were certain private and semi-private comments or scathing about his fear of that tendency. And he was very suspicious, for that reason, to put it mildly, of Gush Emunim type ideology. Very suspicious of it. In the later years, after Camp David, his public remarks were, both to journalists and other public contexts, were that he hopes that God will give the leaders of Israel the wisdom to do the right thing, and he refused to get dragged into anything else. I believe the statement in 67, I wasn't close then, was a freshman, was the first exposure I had to the Rav was that lecture, an interesting baptism of fire, so to speak. I thought he always talked of politics in the middle of public shiurim. But looking backwards, and without direct knowledge, but with my instinctive knowledge, since he never, never intervened in Israeli matters unless he was asked, I am forced to conclude that the only reason he spoke about the matter at that time was because there were too many people in the rabbinate who were closing off options and saying, no, it's us, Shem Panim Ba'Ofen. And he probably felt this was irresponsible and that other people are not willing, other Rabbanim exactly are not willing to stand up. It was necessary for him to intervene. It was not his way to interfere in Israeli matters. The only other time that he interfered directly in 1981, during the first Lebanon War, the Christian militias entered into a refugee camp and they slaughtered people there. It was a question to what degree the certain members of the Israeli government were derelict in allowing this to happen. And the Rav demanded at that time that there be an official commission of inquiry. And the way to support newspapers was not precise, and we'll go into details of it, but there he was adamant, and there I did have a kind of ringside seat because I was bringing him the Israeli newspapers to look at during that month.
I wanted to raise a more basic question, though. Does the Rav's religious Zionism, perhaps as articulated in Kol Dodi Dofeik, does that provide enough of a Zionist vision to energize present-day religious Zionists who are disillusioned, if you will? The extreme reaction to Gush Katif, many people, in fact, there's the Neturei Karta song is now being sung in the in many of these from many of these ex-Gush Katif citizens. There is a huge, huge alienation from Zionism, from the State of Israel, a lack of there's a disidentification. That's the real disengagement, if you will. There's a disengagement from the State of Israel, from a huge, large amount of people, and many people. I think it comes somewhat from the Merkaz HaRav community. I think it's an extreme reaction to what was taught to them. Does the Rav's vision of religious Zionism, is it well enough formulated? Is it too nuanced, perhaps, to re-energize, if you will, or to re-give a new identity to religious Zionism? I was going to have one.
I think the real problem is it's a little late in the game, after people are destroyed, to start, somebody, facing serious surgery, to tell them, well, you should have lost weight 5 years ago, you're in better shape now. It's a little late in the game. And for that reason, it's very painful to say, well, we told you so, we warned you all along that this would happen. That's a real... That's a real problem at this point. I think it's a person who believes that the hand of God is in the State of Israel, that God did do something for us, at whatever level, to say that because the government is not doing what you want right now, because things aren't working out the way you want to right now, that you therefore turn your back on the whole thing is totally irrational. From a religious point of view, say the government, Chilul Shabbos is widespread. This is being done, that is being done. I don't want to say Lashon Hara about Israel. We know what's been going on for 50 years. And Chilul Shabbos is something that is clearly against halacha. I think there's no debate about that. Many other things going on are certainly not good from a halachic point of view, from any religious point of view. Then you come to the question of territories, where if you are a secularist and you don't believe in the halachic necessity of retaining this territory, and these people believe, rightly or wrongly, that some kind of compromise will save their lives, and even halachic decisors are not sure what to do. They say, well, if the government doesn't do what we want now, now we turn our back on the state. That's placing a religious value which is open to debate, and which is a very absolutist religious value, demanding tremendous sacrifice from secular people, assuming they don't believe in that. And making that the make or break of whether Zionism is a good thing or bad thing, it's religiously a very odd way of putting things. You really are taking something marginal and making it into the ikkar. And it's very hard to understand this from a religious point of view, except you'll say, well, over many, many years, people were trained to think that this is really what's most important, and that Shabbos and these other things are relatively marginal matters. There's much more to be said about it, but it really goes beyond the Dov's contribution.
I just want to make a quick comment. I've heard from somebody in the family that the sales of the books that they're selling here, have in recent last couple of years have really done better in Israel than they've done in the States. Traditionally, Rabbi Soloveitchik was not as widely accepted, and there wasn't as much interest in Israel as there was in the States. And as Rabbi Yuval Shurlo, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Petach Tikva, the Yeshiva of Petach Tikva, who's one of the few people who has lectured Israelis, not American Israelis, but Israelis, who have lectured about Rabbi Soloveitchik and written about Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was not necessarily an academic. And he's spoken about this too, and I had a conversation with him, but he said these remarks publicly, that he thinks that traditionally the traditional Dati Lumi student had a very Rav Kook approach to life, where they're inspired by Rav Kook's views of everything, and everything's progressive, everything's getting better, and there's no room for doubt and for suffix, for struggling. And when they read Rabbi Soloveitchik, they're just like, it's painful to read him, and they're not interested. And he thinks that now that things have turned around a little bit in the Rav Kookian, perhaps the Kook camp, their perception of how things should proceed, that there is room now for there to be more interest in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, and people are, in fact, turning to Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings. So he gave some evidence from a talk he'd given and the turnout. So I can't say whether that's true in absolute terms, but there does seem to be a reaction on the ground, some reaction.
I'm wondering, in terms of the contributions that Rabbi Soloveitchik obviously made to Judaism in the modern world, modern Orthodoxy often seems to, I wouldn't say be paralyzed, but sometimes seems constricted by its reliance on Rav Soloveitchik, as if there are no positions that can be taken, no creative thought that can be initiated, unless there's a kind of look backwards to get the kind of sanction, in this case, of course, the posthumous sanction of Rav Soloveitchik. I wonder if whether modern Orthodoxy has been a bit confined in a very poignant way by the Rav's analysis of religion, and whether it's the only boundary marker that it uses for legitimate engagement with modernity, and whether you see in the future, in the coming years, there'll be an attempt to sort of move past, or find new categories of thought that aren't necessarily the Rav's ones for thinking about, you know, modernity.
I'll chop that up into a couple of pieces. I think it certainly is true that on the plane of public policy, there is a reliance on the Rav, which comes mostly from the fact that we do not have gedolim of stature whom enough people will accept. I mean, we have gedolim, but not people who enjoy a wide acceptance. So, for example, on issues like Jewish-Christian relations, we living 45 years after the Rav confrontation about Jewish-Christian encounters, many people argue, look, the positions of the church have changed, the whole relationship between Judaism and Christianity has changed, but all they have to go on really is confrontation, and they have to guess, well, what would the Rav have said? So in that sense, there is a certain kind of paralysis, isn't that, and as the years go on, if we keep relying on the Rav as social, as the social realities change, I think, we will find ourselves in a great deal of difficulty. But on the question of his religious thought, which I think the other piece of what you mentioned, first of all, I think that for the average modern Orthodox Jew, and I would say maybe even the vast majority, what most of them look to in the Rav is simply validation of Zionism, validation of secular studies, and perhaps validation of a positive role of the women in our society. And you can get all those three out of the Rav. The reasoning behind it, the foundations, everything he wrote about it is irrelevant to the vast majority of the people. They know the bottom lines, and they live their lives, and they're not really working through Machshava, which, of course, is one of the things that I think the Rav was distressed by. When you come to thinkers who are doing theology, I don't think it's true that there is an exclusive reliance on the Rav. There is a lot of appeal to, for example, Rav Hirsch, Rav Hoffman, Rav Weinberg, Rav Cook figures in many ways. I'm thinking Rabbi Carmi's work, although he's, a great devotee of the Rav, and one of the Rav's most prized students. Despite that, I think you integrate into your work much material. Some of it secular, some of it religious, and are not really confined in your in your vision. And I think that's true of other people, like for example Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and others who are really pulling from here, pulling from there. There is also in the modern Orthodox community some criticism of the Rav. Now, some people actually take it on. Now, this take him on, in a sense. Way back in 1973, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in one of the very first things he wrote, wrote a lengthy essay in Tradition, which was critical of Lonely Men of Faith. And even Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, as you know from the talk I gave previously, will differ from the Rav's hashkafa on occasion. So I think that there's more... although the Rav may be the focus of a lot, I think that there's also a lot more else going on and a lot more else that's being drawn upon.
Let me add that there are people who clearly are identified as part of the Haredi world who have an important presence in our Huttner, Dessler, and people read it and people think about it. The real distinction is the people who actually are thinking and the people who are not thinking. If you really are thinking about the issues, you're questioning the issues, then whether you like it or not, you're going to read more, you're going to become expansive, you're going to be critical. Your secular reading will be broader, your reading within Yahadut will be broader. My lecture today was really just presenting the Rav without any alternatives, but your lecture, if I were the one giving your lecture, it would have included a lot more of other thinkers, but your presentation was a critical presentation. The real problem is that for many people, the desire to create a certain kind of cult that petrifies thought, and since the Rav did it already, we don't have to do anything on our own. In Gemara, you could call this kind of shallow dafayomi mentality. Without any criticism, people do dafayomi. You go through the motions, you read what you've got to read, you have to give a drasha, so you find, you pick up some kippah, now you can pick up the machzor, and you can take something out of context, and assuming all the button didn't read it, and, my rabbi would have this, the rabbi would have it here, but there. That's a problem with any kind of figure of that sort. And the real borderly real lines are drawn from those people who are seriously thinking and those who are not, those who are looking for an icon or those who are looking for a challenge.
Can I just flip it over on for a second? You're talking about that people are reading, you know, Pachad Yitzchak or whatever other things. Is the reverse true? Are people in the Haredi world reading Rav Soloveitchik? And how do you think they're thinking about Rav Soloveitchik at this point in time?
I can start to address that. I have two sons in Lakewood.
You can say that louder.
My son's obviously been exposed to the Rav. I've kind of forced some tapes on them. There are certain aspects of the Mashava that are alien just simply from the fact that, you know, they just don't have the background. There are certain parts that are, certain things that are coming out that have been accused of being revisionist, specifically there's a sefer called Harare Kedem, which kind of casts the Rav as a standard Rosh Yeshiva. But the Torah is beautiful. I don't think the Torah has been distorted in any way. There's been a lot of talk about how the name Soloveitchik was spelled in the front page, but those things are relatively, obviously, very extremely minor. I wanted to address the previous question, though. I think there's an urgency here. I think that modern orthodoxy itself is threatened by the lack of. I think that modern orthodoxy itself is threatened by the lack of a figure, if you will, that can. Obviously, it's impossible to fill the shoes of the Rav. The Rav was genius cubed. If you look at the sociology of the Haredi community, you will see that they have made huge sacrifices to create one gadol. If you look at a tshuva, a very famous tshuva, Rav Dessler has said that the goal of education is to create one gadol. In other words, 1,000 children are going to go into school. Many of them are going to go off the derech, if you will.
He says they're going to get wrecked. It's the end of Chelek Gimel.
Right.
He's asked by somebody, should I send my about university vis-a-vis? And he says the system was designed basically to create
There's
going to be a lot of casualties, he writes.
So if you look what they're doing, they're sacrificing, the Haredim are sacrificing a large amount. I believe that the phenomenon of people going off the derech was really almost a nevuah from the standpoint of Rav Dessler. In other words, he actually predicted that this thing would take place based on the educational system. That's an interesting question. It's difficult to, obviously, I can't second guess Rav Dessler. I can't second guess Rav Dessler. Right, he wrote a rejoinder, yes. But if you read Rav, this is a totally different subject. It's a very interesting subject. Maybe we could have another. But my point is that given that sacrifice, the creation of Gedolim is in the works. The question is, in 20 years...
Let's do it one at a time.
Okay. The question is, in 20 years... Where will the scales be? And when our children go to Israel for a year and they come back and they make a decision, should we go to Yeshiva University or should we go to Ner Yisrael? I think that where the scales are, will make a lot of that decision. Perhaps what I'm speaking a little out of turn, but when the Rav suggested that some of his best students go to Harvard, I believe he was speaking in a context of the 1950s when there was, in fact, a necessity to prove that orthodoxy can exist within among the best of academia. I think that the imperative perhaps has passed, and now the imperative is to get these guys into the smicha program at YU. And a lot of them, because remember, you're talking about 1,000 in, one out. It's a numbers game almost. You have 5,500 people in Lakewood. That's a lot of people, and these Iluyim have been identified, and you will be seeing these people on the cover of the Jewish Observer in the matter of 10 or 20 years, and modern Orthodoxy is going to be extremely on the defensive. because of this asymmetry.
Fundamental Muslims are also having like 8 kids, so you know they're going to outnumber us too. I don't know if that's the concern is the number issue. I mean, we need people who can look up to as leaders in modern orthodoxy, and I can't tell you exactly how to do that, but I hope that ultimately it'll be the people who are genuine, who are authentic, and who really have a realistic message to speak to the masses, and the masses who are out of step with reality maybe don't need that. But I think for our camp, that's the most important thing.
I'm going to ask a final question, and then we're going to open to the floor. I wanted to ask you what you feel Rav Soloveitchik's ideal Jew is, and this is what I mean. In Halachic Man, the Rav writes the following. When Halachic Man comes across a spring bubbling quietly, he already possesses a fixed a priori relationship with this real phenomenon, that is, the complex of laws regarding the halachic construct of the spring. When halachic man looks to the western horizon and sees the fading rays of the setting sun, or to the eastern horizon and sees the first light of dawn and the glowing rays of the rising sun, he knows that this sunset or sunrise imposes upon him new obligations and commandments. When I come across a passage like this, I'm wondering, how does halachic man, this obviously in a way typology, fit in with the contemporary drive for the spiritual? Because he seems to lack a kind of aesthetic sense, right? He comes to the sunrise and he's thinking certain halachas of the sunrise. He comes to the sunset and he's thinking the same way. He comes to a beautiful river and he's thinking the same way. Who is this guy? Is he a real person? Is he a desirable man to be? Is not this kind of vision a little bit shrunken, a little bit truncated? Does one want to be halachic man? Or is this a straw man set up for other kinds of purposes?
First, I think that the question can actually be strengthened, because there's a passage later on in the work, page 83, I think it is, where he discusses, he talks about Newton, for example, being sort of, you know, ravished by discovering the laws of gravity, and how scientists manage to view the world and all its wonder. And then this goes on for like a page and a half. He says how nature sings a song. And then he says, just so with halachic man. So you expect him to say, the next thing should be, halachic man also marvels at the universe. But instead he talks about how halachic man marvels at the halachic system. So there's definitely a pattern here. I think we have to keep a couple of things in mind. First of all, this work is not necessarily the Rav ratifying the ways of the halachic man. In fact, as people have often pointed out, truly halachic man would not have written the work halachic man. So the Rav was not himself, in that sense, a halachic man, because halachic man would not have spent his time, you know, writing philosophy and so forth. I think that what's going on here is a couple of things. First of all, part of the aim of halachic man is to refute those people, and I guess we could call them maskilim or other sorts of critics, who said that halachic involvement, halachic study, stifles creativity, it stifles freedom, it confines a person into a narrow space, you know, it's stifling to the spirit. And so what the Rav wanted to show is that in the realm of halacha, just through living a halachic life, you can find all the freedom and all the creativity that you know, that you could possibly desire or that you could possibly derive from any secular enterprise. Which I think is why certain other elements of spirituality are left out, because those might involve secular enterprises. Secondly, it could be that the Rav here is speaking about halachic man insofar as he is halachic man. I mean, real-life halachic men, flesh-and-blood halachic men, may have a sense of humor, may take part in sports, may let children ride on them in a game, as Reb Chaim is known to have. He'd get down, you know, and the kids would pile up on top of a horse. None of that has anything to do with what the Rav describes as the role of halachic man. As the real-life halachic man will have characteristics that don't necessarily fit into this grid. Maybe he'll even have, you know, an aesthetic sense. Maybe he'll wonder at the laws of nature. But insofar as he is halachic man, this is the way he looks at things.
I think I said what I needed to say earlier today, on this point. Isha Halacha is a description of a very essential part of Jewish experience, which people don't understand and needs to be explained to them. The more complete pictures which you get in Bikashtem, where you have man searching for God, God searching for man, and where this entire emotional world and in halachic mind, where the Rav speaks about pluralism. The fact that different sciences approach the world in different categories, and halacha is a privileged way of looking at the world for a variety of reasons, but it's one way of looking at the world, among other ways of looking at the world, which have their place and function.
Right, which suggests that the Rav himself may not have been, as I say, ratifying halachic man as the ideal.
I'd like you to give these gentlemen a big hand.